just want to talk about this thing that's in my brain. It keeps me from wanting to come on, but I want some gain. Maybe a little fame.
Yeah. Welcome to the We the Patriots podcast. I am your host, Sal Asante. And today, I have one of my most anticipated guests, something that's been in the works for a while, one of my good friends, Dr. John Marshall. And with me, of course, is Andrew, my co-host. And today, we'll be breaking this podcast into two parts, mainly because I forgot to hit the record button, but also because we had a little bit to add on to the educational side of the podcast, and I wanted to finish up the recording with John a little later on this week. So be on the lookout for part two of this show coming out early next week, most likely. And today we'll be focusing mostly on sports and a lot of John's background in that. So let's get it going.
So I want to get into some of your sports history, John. Did you end up, I know you mentioned earlier, you played basketball and baseball in high school, I believe. You didn't carry any of those into college, did you?
I did play baseball.
Did play baseball.
So I did not play freshman year. Quite honestly, nobody from high school had ever gone to Harvard before, and I wanted to make sure I could do the work. And I said, well, I'm not going to school to play baseball. I mean, my Kinnelon was not exactly a powerhouse. We didn't get scouts or whatever. In fact, my junior year, I think we were 5-15, and I believe pitching, I was 5-3. So you can
kind of goes to show.
You get to see what the rest of the team's record was. And then senior year was not much better. Yes, I was there for school, and I wanted to make sure I could do that. Then after freshman year, I said, okay, you know what? I kind of figured this out. I can do this. And I really missed baseball. I was young enough because I was only 17 when I started college. Okay. So I was 18 the following spring. So I was actually young enough to still play Legion ball. So I played American Legion the summer after my freshman year. So I still had a season that year. And then I kind of said to myself, you know what? I think I can do the work confidently. And so maybe I'll try to walk on. So I went back in the fall, I did walk on, and so I was able to play a little bit for Harvard, and they did have a JV squad. So I kind of got my way in the door there, and
awesome.
Got to play there and, do a little Ivy League stuff for a couple of years.
That's really awesome. How did you like the team over there? What was it like? Was it guys who were just absolute brain guys who were good at baseball, or was it guys who just made the mark for Harvard so they could play baseball?
It was a mix. I would say that the guys I spent most of my time with were also like the kind of more walk-on crowd, and so like there for school, and I mean guys who were biochem majors and stuff like that. And there were even guys who were recruits. There was one fellow who was on the football team who I became friends with and umpired with a little bit. He blew out his knee and he wasn't able to play football that year. So he started working for Rec Sports, which is my campus job as well. And he was like had a 4.0 in pre-med and bio something or another, biomolecular or something. you look at him, and if you just saw him on the street, you'd say, yeah, football player. And then you start talking to him about his schoolwork, and he was the real deal. And then there were some other guys who were, particularly some of the guys who were recruited in, who, I mean, they, I won't say there was anybody who I said, was completely not
it's okay,
deserving
John,
of being there. I'm trying to say this, politely, but I think that there were certainly people that you ran into that, and actually it wasn't just sports. I mean, it was also like people who were, seventh generation descended from a Harvard president or something like that, who you kind of scratched your head and was like, okay, nice enough guy, but yeah.
Right. So in your experience too, how many years did you spend at Harvard?
Four.
4 years. So how was the education while you were there? It wasn't really in social science region, was it?
So my undergrad major was government, with which was kind of like history and political science. Okay. And actually, I had enough credits to either do a history degree or a government degree. And it was just which, seminar I took and, which paper I wrote at the end. And okay. I chose Gov because I had an advisor for junior seminar. Bless you.
That was fun.
Yeah, bless you.
But that's, yes. That's really interesting though. So you went with which way did you go with your degree choosing?
I did government, and it was okay. Because I actually had a junior seminar advisor who I loved, who was a government person, so I kind of stuck with her, gotcha. And that was my way of choosing that. But I almost all of my electives were all history classes, so I could have done
okay.
It
makes sense
either way.
Makes sense. Okay, so when you went there, did you see a lot of politicization of the of just the curriculum at that point? Was there a lot of stuff that seemed like out of left field, like doesn't belong at Harvard? Like I don't know if we constantly see it now, but I think 2017, 2018, 2019, we kept seeing stuff coming up where it's like Harvard's really teaching this type of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, so Harvard is very much a choose your own adventure kind of place.
Gotcha.
And it's actually an interesting commentary because if I were to compare, say, Harvard and Notre Dame, which are the two schools where I kind of like lived in the undergraduate world, even though I was a grad student at Notre Dame, but Notre Dame was obviously much more of a, focused on the community, everything centered around the dorm. It was a lot of sports stuff. And it was, there were a handful of, extracurricular, like anything that you wanted to do, you could do there. So if you wanted to be in the marching band, you could do that. If you wanted to be in some sort of an orchestra, you could do that. But there was, there was an orchestra. At Harvard, there's like 17 orchestras. It's like there's the okay. Bach Orchestra and there's the Ruck,
Mozart
Toscanini orchestra. Chamber Orchestra and the this and that. It was ridiculous. And I mean, I will say that Harvard did a really good job of allowing people to pursue whatever their passions were, no matter how crazy or how ridiculous or whatever. If you said, I wanted to become the world's leading expert on postage stamps, they would have found you a professor that could sit there and point you in that direction. Or if you say, I want to be the, liberal, hippie, trippy, Greta Thunberg, clone, I'm sure they would have found somebody to be your mentor. And, there was also things like, there's the Republican Club. There are a couple different publications that were conservative leaning. The Institute of Politics had fellows from both sides, at least at the time I was there. It still holds true to some degree. I will say that there have been a couple retirements of noted conservatives and not necessarily some backfilling along those lines. And I would say that some of the fellows at the Institute of Politics, which typically used to swing back and forth as, during the Clinton years, you had a lot of Republicans who were fellows because they were not in power at the time. And then once Bush got elected, you had a lot of Democrats come over because, the former Clinton administration officials, it's like, oh, well, landing at Harvard is not a bad place to land now that I'm out of, I'm not secretary of whatever labor anymore. So now I can go teach at Harvard. Right. So there's always had been that kind of pendulum thing. I don't like, I guess I haven't followed exactly who the fellows are now, but I don't know that there's a lot of former Trump officials who are IOP fellows
which
would have been the usual pattern. Like, okay, Biden's administration comes in, all the Democrats go to Washington, the Republicans go to the universities. And I think that some of the universities like, quite honestly, in the Sun Belt states tend to be getting a lot more of those conservative ex-officials now, and probably fewer of them going to Harvard.
That would definitely make sense.
But I think I really don't think I felt the indoctrination as much as, you know, maybe it might even be happening today much more. So, I mean, I have to remember it's 20 years. It's a long time.
It's a long time. And
in some respects, I think I was just there, but on the other hand, 20 years is a long time. I will say, I definitely had instructors who were, I had one in particular. I really only had one that I felt was truly unfair, in the sense that
very biased.
It was a class called Liberal and Conservative. It was actually a writing class. It was a class where it was a freshman seminar, actually, to teach you how to write. And you could take all these different topics. Like you could have picked a class on geology, or you could have picked a class on journalism or whatever. And so you picked whichever topics you thought was interesting. Well, me being the dumb freshman I was, I said, "Ooh, liberal and conservative. That sounds like politics. I should get involved. I should do that one." Not having the foresight to say, well, at Harvard, liberal and conservative means it's being taught by a liberal. And I've always prided myself on being a pretty good writer, and I could just, no matter what I wrote, I could have written something Pulitzer worthy, and this professor was just not having it because we didn't see eye to eye. And there was just, I'm like, well, even when I tried to be sort of moderate, that was still not nearly towing the party line enough for what he was looking for. And it was just kind of a no-win thing. But I had a number of other professors who were, I'm sure, politically to the left, but
didn't display it.
Clearly, it at least didn't impact their grading, which I give them credit for that. And I will also say I probably learned to be a little more guarded as to how I wrote things too, which,
sure,
you know,
absolutely. So as you,
I will say, I think I probably came out of Harvard more conservative than I went in.
Oh, really?
Because I think it's whenever you get challenged in any way, because I mean, you're surrounded, but it's still a liberalish campus. I mean, most of the students are on the left. And so you're constantly surrounded by opinions that you don't necessarily share. You have to figure out ways to, you know, survive and exist and not pick fights left and right. And but it also forces you to make more cogent arguments, because when you're dealing with people who are putting you on the spot, you've got to be able to explain yourself.
Right.
And then if they're so blinded by their ideology that they're not, don't want to listen, then that's on them. But, you know, at least if you're going to try to defend a point, it's got to be reasonably well articulated.
Well, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. And you're put in a spot where you just emboldened some things that you thought, I'm sure, made you rethink a lot of things as well.
Yeah, and I think that there were, I mean, I will say that coming out of a relatively, you know, insulated, you know, experience in a small little public school in New Jersey, I mean, there were issues and stuff like that I hadn't even heard of, that people are, you know, out there writing papers about and protesting about. And it's like, oh, well, never heard of that one before. And then kind of forces you to learn and see what's going on. And I think definitely in the international space, I mean, I had a fairly good handle on domestic issues, I thought. But when you go to things like, you know, a model UN or something like that, and you hear of all these things going on around the world, and, you know, Harvard's got people from all over the world. And so you have people who have familiarity with issues that you've never even heard of. And, you know, I think that was, it kind of put you on the spot to sit there and say, okay, not only do I need to understand this, but now I need to develop an opinion on it based on what I'm learning here. And I think to do it right, you can't just, you know, jump at the first position that you hear and say, okay, well, that's your side. I get it. But there has to be another side of the story. Let me understand what that is, and then I can better evaluate this.
Yeah, definitely. So I really wanted to finish up on some of the sports stuff, some of the stuff that I know in common, and lighten some of the mood that we have going here.
Yeah, we've definitely had a very business Zoom meeting going on here.
For sure. No, it's because we have no alcohol going. We just need to get it next time with a couple bottles. We'll be all right. But when you left Harvard, how long did you take away from the sport of baseball specifically? Because I'm sure you weren't doing as much basketball being on the baseball team.
Honestly, I've always been doing something. I mean,
you never stopped. That's awesome.
Never stopped. So I went from Harvard, I was playing, and then I actually went back and I coached over the summers. I coached the American Legion team after I had aged out of it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I did. And then when I started teaching, I immediately started coaching. In fact, even that first year out of college, when I had kind of gone from consulting to then like a long-term sub, I was helping out with the Kinnelon High School team at that point. Following year, when I was teaching full-time, I became a full-time coach for baseball. The following year after that, I picked up basketball as well. So I was doing both sports and I kept on doing that. And I was actually playing semi-pro league over the summers on my own. Okay. I was teaching, I picked up that, played for the worst team on the face of the earth because I found a league. I said, you know, I kind of miss playing on my own. I was still coaching, but that's coaching is one thing. You're throwing BP, but you're not really playing. Right. And I was missing it. And I started looking around and I found an adult league, 18 plus league. And I said, all right, this is cool. I mean, I emailed the commissioner and said, hey, you know, I'm back in New Jersey and here's my background. And they were like, oh, okay. Where are you located? And okay. Well, there's a team based out of Rockaway that's coming together. They really need some help. Should have been an alarm bell.
Oh boy.
Oh my gosh.
Chinese communist parade full of red flags right there.
Yeah, it was brutal. And they weren't bad guys, but none of them were really baseball players. And, it was the motliest team ever assembled.
That's awesome.
The uniform was a t-shirt they were the Gray Bears was the name of the team, and the mascot was two bears humping. It was just really it was terrible. And but thankfully, you know, and I pitched like practically every inning of every game, and my arm would fall off every week. It was so bad. Like I would go into school like on Monday morning because we'd play on Sundays, and like I'd have to like lift up my arm through like with my other arm so I could write on the chalkboard because my arm was so dead. I mean,
yeah,
like nobody could make a play behind me. Like I was throwing 200 pitches every week. It was just awful. But I did get seen by one of the other teams in the league that was probably the best team in the league, and they were so like, are you like friends with these guys? And I'm like, well, you know, I'm playing with them because they put me on this team. And they're like, okay, next year you come play with us. And thankfully the Gray Bears disbanded and I was able to go play for this other semi-pro team after that. And played with them for a number of years and went out to Indiana, played out there.
Really?
Yeah. I umpired while I was in Notre Dame and did some intramural stuff there. Started playing a lot more basketball out there because it's always easy to get games. And Notre Dame actually has like great basketball. They have the world's largest outdoor 5-on-5 tournament, bookstore tournament, which is pretty cool. And in South Bend, which is really cold in the winter, indoor sports are definitely have an advantage. So I started playing a lot of hoops out there. When I was in Indianapolis for a couple of years, I kept on playing both. I'd play hoops after work. I'd play baseball on the weekends. And then, came back here again, picked it up. So
yeah, you never left it. That's really
never left it. Awesome. And I, I still play. I play basketball at, you know, minimum 3 times a week, usually sometimes 4 or 5. And then baseball on Sundays.
Men's league. So now that you're doing all this, have you maintained your fandom the whole time with baseball?
Pretty much. Okay. I think it, I will say, you know, there was a time, you know, when you're, I think when you're younger, and also, I mean, when I was very lucky that, I mean, I became a Yankees fan in the 80s. So I came by honestly right when the time. Yankees were terrible, yeah. You know, back in the, I mean, it was Mattingly and not much else in the late 80s. And so like in the 90s, when they started kind of getting good, everybody was like, oh, you're bandwagon. Like, no. I've been a Yankees fan since the beginning. Like I suffered through Stump Merrill and through Dallas Green and through like a lot of the Bucky Dent, manager and, you know,
yep.
You know, suffered through all that. I deserve the
real fandom star,
the core 4, core 5 Yankees. So,
yep.
But no, so but I will say that I think as you get older, like your relationship to the sport changes as a fan. Sure. Like, I think that, you know, I don't necessarily hang on every inning and every pitch the way I might have years ago.
Right.
So.
So have you been following much of the new year that's been going on so far?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say I watch every game, but, and heck with the way they, like, oh, this tonight's on Apple Plus and tomorrow's on Amazon.
I can't even,
you can't,
have you gotten to see any of that guy Volpe that I got to play against?
Yes. He's very smooth. I mean, when rookies come up, you always kind of look at it and say like, is this kid, you know, looking like they're overmatched, and he never seems to be, he never gives you that impression that he's just overmatched. He's
definitely not.
So I think he's impressed me from what I've seen so far.
That's pretty awesome. And the team is kind of just like teetering, it seems like, with these injuries. But
yeah,
on the whole, I know I haven't gotten to see too many like violations of these new rules that have come out, but as you've been watching or seeing any sort of highlights or anything, is there anything you're noticing that just doesn't seem right or is actually good? Like, have you gotten any read on these new rules yet?
Yeah. So, all right. So here's the thing. I think that the best rule changes are the ones that you can't see. Like it should feel unnoticeable. When they limited the number of mound visits, you know, I loved the Yankees in the late 90s. I loved Jorge, but like he was went out to the mound way too much. Like he was at every other pitch and, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th inning. I mean, Jorge Posada, he wore a track out.
Running back. Yeah.
Oh, it was crazy. So that was getting excessive. And when they capped the number of mound visits, like you really didn't even notice it. It just kind of cut out some of that unnecessary stuff. And yeah, I know there was like a little spot on the scoreboard somewhere that said, you know, mound visits remaining, but like it never really came into play as far as I could tell. I mean, it was very, very rarely did teams use them all. I think that some of the changes that were made this time were a little too much, too fast. I think, and some of them were unnecessary, like the bases thing, like, do you really notice it? Nah, I won't say I notice it watching the games, but on the other hand, like it just seemed like they were trying to fabricate something. Like, we're trying to get you to steal more bases, right? So we're going to make these things bigger.
Like, I don't know. You watch Jose Altuve step on that thing. He looks like he's standing on a whole planet. So
that's
definitely bigger.
Yeah. If it was something that was done for like player safety or whatever, like the, you know, I get it because I've played first base. I mean, the collisions at first base that can happen, you know, when guys are, when a play is bang bang and ankles are coming together, like those are, you know, I don't discount the fact that there is an issue there. It happens.
Right.
But if it's done just to try to manufacture more stolen bases, like that,
right.
You know, that seems kind of silly. The, you know, the shifting thing, like I think I really wish that had been solved organically. Like, I don't think Major League Baseball needs to make rules to help Joey Gallo's average. Like, if you're so incapable of adjusting what you're doing that you can't slap a ball the other way and get them to stop shifting on you, well, then, you know, maybe you're not that great of a hitter. So, you know, I think Wade Boggs was asked about that, and he was like, if they shifted like that on me, I'd hit 400 every year.
Hit 400. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I think the same thing with a Derek Jeter, like anybody who's got a good contact hitter. I mean, why did LeMahieu win the batting title the year he was healthy? Well, you can't shift on him because he hits, he pulls it down the line. He sprays it the other way. It's, and I think it would, if you had allowed it to kind of progress organically, you would have seen organizations, teaching their kids in the minor leagues, here's how you lay down a bunt, and that would have become a part of the game. Or how do you slap the ball the other way?
Right.
Because honestly, if half of these guys could just have bunted, I mean, Rizzo did it a handful of times last year when they overshifted him, where he just dropped a bunt down the third base line.
It's a free base hit.
Absolutely. Free base runner, free base hit. And I get that you'd love for him to hit a double or hit a home run, but like, you know, base runners are valuable too. And
yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't agree more with that.
So I think that this, in some ways, it's almost like what we were talking about with the education before. It's like this feeling like you have to do something that, you know, most things do correct themselves. I think the thing with the pitch clock,
thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah. It's such a big thing.
I'm not a fan. I think the number one, this whole thing about like, we're just going to strike people out if you take too long, or, oh, you weren't looking at the pitcher or what. And I don't know. It's, you got to say it has accomplished their goal. I mean, average game times are definitely shorter.
Yeah. I think they went down by like 35 minutes on average so far, or 30 minutes or so.
But it's also, is it a better product? I mean, if you're watching the game on television, more of the time that you're standing in front of the television. If you're talking about watching a baseball game on television, it just means that more of the time that you're sitting in front of the television, you're going to be watching advertising, because a higher percentage of the time is spent. I mean, you still have inning breaks. You still have the same number of innings, the same number of breaks between innings. Haven't gotten any shorter. So you're just sitting there watching, a higher percentage of your time is watching commercials instead of watching the game. Second of all, baseball, it's not supposed to be like a game that has a shot clock or a play clock where you're under pressure all the time. I mean, one of the beauties parts of baseball is to be able to sit back and relax and watch a game and hear somebody like a Vin Scully telling stories about the game. And, you know, it's, you know, now it's, I mean, I don't know if you watched, I watched a little bit of last night's game, and it's like these innings are going so fast. I mean, not that, you know, Ryan Rucco and Jeff Nelson were exactly going to, you know, they're not Vin Scully, that's for sure. But they wouldn't have had time to tell a story even if they wanted to. I mean, it was
What I've noticed is you watch a game and the announcers can't even talk. Mm-hmm. They need to look at the screen like this and watch every second, or else they're going to miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, it feels like they're, I mean, it depends a little on the pitcher, but some of them, it just kind of feels like this whole thing is, you know, artificially sped up. I don't know. I mean, I think it, there's got to be a happy median between the goal of reducing the length of the game and a sort of draconian pitch clock that, where you're penalized, that you're giving strike penalties to a guy like the kid from the Pirates who major leagues. He gets called up after like 13 years in the minors, and he gets a nice standing ovation from the crowd.
And then a pitch clock.
And then he gets a pitch clock violation because he was sitting there like acknowledging the crowd too long. I mean, like, come on, like, there's got to, maybe it's more umpire discretion. I don't even love the idea of having a clock.
At least I had what I needed close by. But yeah, I don't even think that the pitch clock even has a place. And you see it, in my opinion, what I was talking about with one of my coaches that I work with is that you see it more with the relievers. The relievers are so much more dependent on a timing mechanism, on making sure they're ready for their pitch, zoning in, giving it their best effort, because they only have 20 pitches. Mm-hmm. And you're going to make them fire those bullets now every 20 seconds.
Yep.
And you see it, the game changes, the base runners are taking advantage almost every time there's a reliever on the mound. And I think that plays a bigger part even in the stolen base thing than the bases, is how much the runners are just taking advantage of that countdown.
The other thing I think you're seeing is, I mean, it also feels like hitters are kind of rushed into the box and don't necessarily have the time to kind of sit there and get themselves paired to hit.
Right.
I would not be shocked if you see a lot of the offensive metrics end up going down, despite the fact that they think that, you know, the intention was we're going to create more action. I think what you're getting, you're probably getting less. I mean, I haven't seen the stats, so I'm just guessing, but this is my perception from having watched some of these games. You're getting a little less on the three true outcomes baseball, which may be a good thing, because I was getting a little sick of that. But you're getting a lot more like first pitch ground balls to short, first pitch pop-ups, because guys are getting in the box and all of a sudden there's a ball in front of them and they can't step out. They can't, or they can step out one time, but then after that they're locked in the box. They're afraid of getting called for a pitch clock violation if they got, you know, something in their eye or whatever. And so they, you know, they go up there and hack away a little bit. And, you know, I think the Rangers games the last couple nights have been distinctly rushed feeling on both sides. I mean,
right. Yeah, I don't know. It's just a different product. It's different, and it's really different because I'm out here coaching regular baseball, and then I go and watch a different product when I can see it, which I think was another huge point you brought up before. Mm-hmm. How hard is it to watch these games even nowadays? You're trying to make it more watchable for viewers. Like, I know for a fact that my grandfather was still alive trying to watch baseball right now, he would have quit 2 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, my grandpa watched, you know, he was even over 100 years old. Like, he still watched most of the games, and he would stay up sometimes even for the night games because he enjoyed it. You know, there was something he could kind of relate to on a daily basis. And I know my mom watches a lot of the games, but when they're on Amazon or if they're on Apple TV, she's, maybe she puts it on the radio, maybe she just doesn't watch it at all. And
right, exactly.
You know, it's, unfortunately, the people who are actually watching on a day-to-day basis are, you know, they're not necessarily going to have all these technology things. And like, I think it's becoming a lot of, you know, these corporate decisions that are influencing how decisions are made about the game. And I mean, it's nothing new. I mean, when I was, when I was a kid, there was, the Yankees, some of their games were on PIX 11 and some of their games.
I remember that. Right. Some were on Sports 11 and some were on,
Sports Channel, which was a paid, that was even before MSG. MSG was eventually came in as a free cable network, but before that it was Sports Channel, which you had to pay extra for, and we didn't. So I could only see the games that were on PIX. I think that they realized, and the Yankees, of course, took the extra step of creating their own network, that there was a great deal of value in having, you know, access to the Yankees on a day-to-day basis. And I mean, it certainly didn't hurt jersey sales or fandom or anything like that.
I want to ask you if you remember this part of I don't know if it was when they first started, but I'm a kid. So 2007, 8, 9 time or so, maybe right when Gary Sanchez is about to come up. They had thing. It was like Yankees dugout or something like that, or pinstripes, Yankees pinstripes or something. And they would go out specifically for the kids. it was obviously a kid's show, but they'd go and talk to all the Yankees. They'd go do some drills. They'd go like take in the locker room that day or whatever it was. It was the best show for kids. And if I was just thinking about it right now, it popped in my head. If that was here today, how many you wouldn't need all of these different streaming services. Yankees would be like, I'm good. We have enough of our bases coming from these kids who want to come to the Bronx Day and want to do all these different events. I don't see that anymore.
Yeah. And I think that the Yankees probably would have probably said, you know, we're good regardless, that a lot of these decisions were being made by MLB, league wide, where it's like, we're going to have this MLB partnership with Amazon and so many games are going to be on that. So I don't think it was necessarily the Yankees' choice to do that type of stuff, but again, it's the league meddling with the individual teams and markets. And, you kind of look back to the history. I mean, the whole antitrust exemption thing.
Right.
There's a reason why it's been an issue since the 50s, is that it has always felt a little quirky, and that a league could just have an exemption to what is essentially a monopoly and being able to force their franchises to do these different things.
Well, now you mentioned that. That's a great point, though. But don't you think, and you're a history buff, you'd probably know much better than me, don't you think that that's become a problem in almost every facet of life now? How big just corporations have become in general? Look at Amazon, for example.
It's institutionalism. Corporate, whether it's corporations or government or sports leagues, or take it down to like the recreational stuff. Basic, little league and town rec league. That was what there was. And then we got a little older, you played Legion ball. And that's what there was. Now there's travel teams, there's this, there's that, there's prospects this, and there's, showcase that. Showcase, and there's it never ends. And why? Because people realize they can make some money off of it and find it. And even the people like the well-meaning parents who say, well, I want to give my kids, the opportunity to play with the best teams out there and, learn from the better coaches and all that. I think they kind of get sucked in by this notion that if they're not on the right team, well, then they're not going to get the college scholarship, and then they're not going to play for the Yankees. And it's just so dispiriting to think that that's the way that, if you're just an ordinary kid with ordinary parents, that it's hard to get that kind of exposure.
It's really tough. And I know, like, when I was a kid, for me specifically, reason I moved to club baseball is I got cut from town. Like, we didn't have a great town system, in my opinion, where it was very, very politicized. It was all brought into one group of people who made a lot of the decisions. And it carried down for years. And that prompts you to start your own league, but then it starts the forest fire that we have now, like we were just mentioning. Yeah, you can't stop it once it's out of the bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that when you look at society in general, we've become a very litigious society. We've become a very... Yeah, for sure. Institution friendly in the sense that people find comfort in that sort of like, oh, well, they're an established institution. They should know what they're doing, whether it's, the governmental thing, or even you look at the proliferation of like chain restaurants and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, there are no mom and pop places. Maybe in the restaurant field there are still some, but like, you don't find mom and pop drugstores out there very much anymore. That used to be the heart of every town, and now it's like everything's Walgreens and CVS. It's the way that it's gone. Why? Because when you're talking about everything's become more complicated. It's not just Dr. Brown calls up the local pharmacy, it's, you know, oh, well, this provider network has to bill Medicare, and then who's got their special ID card to go, like, well, you know, how
does your plan even cover this medication? Do we have to go generic? Do we have to find another replacement?
Yeah. How does a little mom and pop pharmacy compete with, you know, Walmart and CVS that have computers that do all this stuff for them and stuff? So it's tough
making the medicines, like, yeah, just doing it for them. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think when you're looking at things like sports leagues and whatever, I think that they're not doing this in a vacuum. It's part of a larger societal trend
for sure.
That they are, you know, that the big institution can somehow produce better outcomes by meddling with the results. But I think what you've seen in the NBA is probably the best example of it, that they've changed rules. They've talked about how they officiate the game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally different product. If you watch a high school game versus an NBA game, it's just,
oh, yeah, 100%.
It's barely the same sport.
I was going to say, it doesn't look like you're watching basketball.
No, I mean, the NBA, it's like, for one thing, half of the violations don't get called. The the defense, like the illegal defense rules they put in a number of years ago that prevented any sort of zones and matchups. And it's like, you know, you're just meddling because what did they want to do? They wanted to promote more scoring. Okay, we'll do this. We'll do that. We'll change the game in such a way that we get the outcomes we want. And I kind of feel like that's what baseball is doing with these, with some of the rules they're doing. But is that really for the best? You watch a good 14, I was supposed to umpire a 14U game today, but it got rained out.
Yep.
You watch a good, well-played 14U game with kids who know what they're doing. It doesn't take 3.5 hours. The kids don't take 45 seconds between pitches. They get the ball, they get their sign, they pitch.
Hour, you know, 52 hours.
Yeah. It moves and kids go up there swinging the bat. They're not, you know, it's a good product. And yet, I mean, I realize that there's different stakes involved at Yankee Stadium, but right, I don't think that the game is inherently something that needed to be meddled with, where, you know, because I'm sure that in that 14U game, if they wanted to go have a, you know, We don't have a limit on the number of, you know, conferences on the mound. We don't have, you know, if they want to shift, they can shift. But I mean, yeah, they're doing it, and
they know what's probably going to happen is that they're going to get bit from the behind. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think it's a good place to wrap up. But I think it plays into it societally, on way too many levels. Plays in big business. It plays into leagues like this. It plays into an educational system or a government that just gets so big that I feel like accreditation by name is good enough now. Mm-hmm. Whereas if any time, now is the time to do your research, because things are seemingly so vague.
Yeah. When I was in college, I took a class called Baseball in American Society. It was a history class.
That sounds like one I'd like.
It's funny because like all of us, you know, who love baseball, all take the class, and then they the first midterm was like the hardest midterm I think I had in all 4 years of Harvard.
Really?
It was a killer because I think he wanted to emphasize like this is a legitimate history class. This is not sit around and talk about baseball. And so the midterm was like all of this like social history stuff that, I mean, it connected to baseball, but it was not just like, let's talk about the Yankees. It was like, you know, analyze the women's movement of the 1870s in relation to this. And it was like, whoa, that was not what I was expecting. So,
right.
But anyway, so he killed us all in the midterm. But after that, we kind of figured out, all right, this is what he wants. But at the very end of the class, the professor, Bill Gnapp, said, his kind of conclusion at the end of the course was a quote, and I wish I could remember who the quote was originally from, but it was somebody from the early days of baseball back in like the Judge Landis era. And the quote was, baseball must indeed be a great game. for it to overcome or to survive the fools that run it. And I think it certainly is true, you know, of a lot of sports these days and probably baseball too.
No, I couldn't agree more, John. Well, I'm going to say that's a good wrap up point. We've been at this for a while now.
Yeah.
I think it's time you get.
I'll have to do some editing to keep it manageable.
I definitely have some editing to do. I got some work to do. Hopefully by the time I'm done, we're allowed to post on YouTube again. So we'll see you guys then. Get everything up and going. John, like I said, thank you again. It's been a blast. And we'll try to have try to get on with Father Ed soon.
Sounds great, Sal.
All right, John. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Take care now.
Everybody, thank you for making this far and for watching the episode. I just wanted to give you just a huge thank you. And for that, thank you to all of our viewers. We are now live with our website, and that is WeThePatriotsMedia.com. There, you are going to catch our new patron program, which could not come at a better time with us receiving another strike on YouTube. So without any further ado, go ahead and head over to WeThePatriotsMedia.com. Go check out our members section where you can get access to all our bonus content, as well as our new shop, which is going to have a few t-shirts and maybe some hoodies to start off, but we are going to be loading that up with quite a bit of apparel. We want to know what you'd really like to see when it comes to apparel-wise, or what type of stuff you might want to see in the store. So send us your feedback. Let us know what you'd be looking for. We'll catch you on the next episode. I've been loving this and could not wait to show you what we've been working on behind the scenes. So hope you love it. Let us know.
I'ma make all peace out. These bitches say, damn, I wish I were the fucking state. I wanna be something, not nothing. Trapped inside my dream and I'm running. Running away from these demons. But the feeling's so good, I'ma keep dreaming.